Matt Heimovitz, you're really famous for the way that you have taken music to people in so many ways. How far back in your life and career does that desire go? Were you doing that as a student, as a kid?
It goes back to when I first started playing the cello, actually, because I do remember very well the excitement of, you know, learning a new piece or new song and wanting to share that with whoever stepped into our home back then in California, in Palo Alto, California. For me, it was very exciting to make a discovery. And then, you know, even as an 8-year-old or 9-year-old, have someone right there and realize that what I'm doing really is not for myself, but actually to be shared with someone else. And I really was very excited to play for whomever would show up.
So as a 9-year-old kid, how did your friends handle that? Did they stay far away for fear that you'd drag them into it, or did you convince them?
it was a little bit of there's some tension there. They wanted me to go out on the streets and play some soccer with them, you know. So yeah, there was in terms of my own generation, that's another story. I mean that there was always some tension in terms of you know what it was I was doing and why I spent so much time. Why would I want to spend 4 or 5 hours practicing the cello when I could be doing other things? I still loved playing video games and I loved playing soccer on weekends, and I loved doing all kinds of regular kids stuff too. But I did start my focus very early with the cello and with music, and that became priority. And so I sort of gravitated more to relationships with adults early on. I mean, you know, even with music, making music with older musicians that I was surrounded with and trying to learn from.
And so you earlier mentioned your own generation. How has that played out in the last 15 years of your life as you've moved from kid to adult and you moved through those famous 20-something years in which we fear that nobody wants to hear classical music and all those things? How's what you've done worked with the people your age as you've gone along?
Well, I've found that when you take classical music, you take that tradition outside of the norm. If you take it out of the concert hall and you play it, you know, last 15 years I've brought it to rock and roll clubs and jazz clubs and coffee houses, and then really lately, you know, thinking of it that any space can be turned into a place that's receptive to music, all of a sudden you're breaking down a lot of the barriers, and people are more comfortable listening, and there's not they don't feel that they have to be brought up in a certain routine or a certain way of responding to it. They can respond honestly to it without feeling intimidated or uncomfortable about it. And so I've felt, you know, more and more I've had really wonderful experiences with my own generation, and it's just a matter of making the effort to meet them and make the effort to sort of get the word out, communicate to people what it is that we're trying to do and what, you know, why music is so important in our lives.
And what are some anecdotes of success in doing that? You must have a whole handful of lovely little stories and moments that you've encountered.
Oh my gosh, they vary. I mean, pretty much every experience, some, you know, things tend to happen. I mean, one story that I loved when I was on my alternative tour years ago, I ended up at a place in Miami. It was called Churchill's, and it's kind of a hip hop joint, and it's in the middle of a Haitian slum in downtown Miami. And I went in and I had, you know, it wasn't a big audience, but the 2,000 people who were there, each one, you know, came from a totally different ethnic background. And, you know, when I mentioned that I was going to play Golijov, some Latin composer, you know, a Latin couple beamed and was very happy when I mentioned I was going to play something that was influenced by John Coltrane, Love Supreme. Some jazz music lovers, you know, were very happy. And then when I said that I was going to play Bach for them, the guy sitting there who looked like he was from the hip-hop world with metal teeth and tattoos all over his body and, you know, this African-American suddenly beamed, you know, that I was going to go play Bach. And so, you know, it's like, don't judge a book by its cover. I had no idea this guy sitting there was a Bach lover, and there, you know, there he was. So, you know, something like that, where you realize that over the course of an evening you play music that speaks to different people and in different ways, and the power of music that it can bring all of these people together.
Let's talk a bit about our colleagues as musicians, because we know an awful lot of classical musicians who are fairly defensive and they don't take chances, and they're not going to extend themselves for fear of having one incorrect note played in public or something like that. I gather that's not been a neurosis you've ever had.
Well, you know, we do too like to keep standards high in the classical music world, and for me that is important. I mean, and yet, I think anything that you do based on fear is probably not productive and not conducive to inspiration and to reaching your best and reaching your goals. So I think, you know, in anything you do, you have to take risks and you have to try. You can't be afraid of failure, because that comes along with it. So, and on the other hand, you know, we do prepare a lot. We spend, you know, I spent many hours practicing and thinking about the music and studying and doing what I can to prepare. And so, you know, I'm trying to be at my best whenever I perform in front of people. But at the same time, I've learned over time and with experience to embrace my own vulnerabilities and my own flaws, and the idea that, you know, that's one of the great aspects of performing, is that it's dangerous. You know, anything can happen, and just to embrace that philosophy.
Do you find that your example is rubbed off on a generation of musicians?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if it's a whole generation, but I know, you know, I have my own students at McGill University, my cello studio, and the students I come into contact with over there. And, you know, I try to set an example, and it is encouraging to see, you know, more and more presenters taking risks in terms of programming and being open to more progressive programs, and one that juxtapose, you know, different genres and different styles of music, different epics. And, it's encouraging. I think, you know, to see these kinds of changes happening in the classical world. They happen fairly slowly, especially in the orchestral world, maybe even slower than some of the presenters of chamber music and subscription series. But, you know, the whole world is changing so fast. I mean, faster than ever, and technologically, and in terms of how people experience music and how it gets distributed. And so I think we all have to be incredibly flexible and evolve with the times.
And talk about your musical relationship with Chris O'Reilly.
Chris is, he's like a brother, and we share many, many musical passions, and we started off our collaboration sort of looking at the, you know, the Duke Ellington model of music, where there are two kinds. There's good music, and then there's the other kind. And so whether it came from Radiohead or Stravinsky or Bernard Herrmann or John McLaughlin, we voraciously, just built up our own repertoire, and then we kind of went back. The latest project was called Beethoven Period, and we went back to the origin of the cello piano. Beethoven putting the cello and piano sonata on the map, really. And we approached this from the original tools of the time. So looking with a beautiful forte piano, the Broadwood that he played, and I set up my cello with death strings. In fact, I'm meeting Chris in Buffalo in a few hours, and we're going to do a Beethoven cycle there. So, and we're cooking up a couple of other projects now. We never know what's next in a way between us, but it's fun to have someone that's on that kind of wavelength and open to really thoughtful and innovative programming. And Chris is also, he's a voracious reader, and we have fun with political discussions and other aspects of life, food and drink as well. But he is also someone that I think, in today's world, has done more for the next generation of musicians than anyone I can think of. I mean, he's really, sort of since Leonard Bernstein, in some ways, he's done incredible things to inspire the young generations and what's possible for them in music. So it's great to work with someone like that.
And I asked you earlier, kind of anecdotally, of the effect that you've found on audiences. Now, more measurably, that famous or infamous idea of, classical music is dying and it's graying and it's aging and all of those things. How do you feel about classical music right now in 2015?
Well, I'm always the eternal optimist, but I do think that in many ways we live in a golden age of music, and in the sense that if we were around 50 years ago or 100 years ago, we would have missed all of the incredible music that was written after that. So we now have this perspective, and we can look back and kind of make sense of it all. And we're not in a straitjacket. We can pick what we want to listen to and what we want to pursue and find connections between the centuries and between the genres and so on. So I actually think that that aspect, and also the aspect that it's just so easy, more and more so, to have access to anything that you want at your fingertips. And so in that way too, it's kind of amazing to, 200, 300 years ago, there was no way you could listen to a Beethoven symphony again, unless it was performed live. And so the idea that we can now compare, two dozen recordings of a Beethoven symphony, that I think there are many great things about that. Of course, there are also challenges, in terms of what I found, I'm amazed that with all the changes happening around us, people still want to go out and experience music live collectively in a way that brings the community together, and that you just can't replace that. You can't replace this live exchange of ideas of art. And in that sense, I think signs of or people saying that the death of classical music is imminent is just very premature, and it just won't happen because the music is too great.
Speaking with Matt Heimovitz, who's coming to Spokane to play with the Gonzaga Symphony, and it's the Barbara Concerto. Talk about playing a piece like that, and specifically playing it with essentially a community orchestra.
Well, I the Barbara Concerto is one of the greats, cello concertos. Of course, the famous one, if you have to pick one of all of them, is the Dvorak Cello Concerto, which he wrote in New York. And so the Dvorak Concerto is really an American concerto, but the Barber is completely made in the USA also. And it's written in 1945, so it's kind of a fascinating year, post-World War II recording and it, recording, sorry, concerto. And it just deals with all of, you know, the climate, what was happening in the air in 1945, and just very beautiful. I think people will recognize the slow movement. They'll immediately think of Barber's famous adagio that is all over the place, you know, in Platoon, and has music film scores, and we hear all the time as music that comforts and with extraordinary beauty. So it's beautiful writing for the cello. It's virtuosic. It really stretches the parameters of what the cello can do, maybe even more than the Dvorak concerto. And it really also, in a wonderful way, kind of develops the idea of cadenza, the idea that when the cello plays alone in relationship to the orchestra, Barber was quite innovative in how he deals with that, and it's a beautiful metaphor for sort of the individual and society, and you know, sort of the individuals striving to get their voice heard.
And so that's what we'll get to experience on Monday night at the Fox with the Gonzaga Symphony and my guest, Matt Heimovitz. Matt, thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.